Welcome to the Perky Book Talk Podcast. I'm William Armstrong. I write reviews every week for the Hurriyet Daily News, and in this podcast I talk to authors about a newly released book on Turkey and its region. This week I reviewed Ahmet Ağaoğlu and the Genealogy of Liberalism in Turkey by Ozan Özavcı, published by Brill. Ağaoğlu is known in Turkey as one of the most prominent liberal figures of the early Republican era, and today he has a reputation as a liberal individualist. The book critiques this reputation and presents Ağaoğlu as a more sophisticated figure, trying to balance individual and state interests in Turkey of the 1920s and 1930s. You can find a link to my review of the book via my blog, as well as a link to an edited version of this interview with Ozan Özavcı at the Hurriyet Daily News. Also on my blog, I've reposted a link to an earlier related interview that you may find interesting with scholar Alexandros Lamprau on the heritage of state social engineering in Turkey. Ağaoğlu was born in the South Caucasus in 1868 and grew up there before moving to St. Petersburg, Paris and Baku. I started by asking Ozan Özavcı about how Ağaoğlu's wandering early life shaped his later thinking in the Ottoman Empire and the Republic of Turkey.
Indeed, he lives in several different countries, which leads his biographers would probably see four or five different Ağaoğlus who took different roles in each of these countries. He lived in the Russian Empire, in France, in the Ottoman Empire, in the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan, and in the Republic of Turkey, and four or five different cities. And in each of those cities he goes, he is being nurtured by new ideas. As you say, he was born into a Shiite family, a rich landowner family, where he receives a very traditional religious education until he is probably 12 or 13. And then his mother wants Ahmet Ağaoğlu to enroll in modern Russian schools. And once he is enrolled in one of those, he is introduced to the ideas of Russian radicalism through his teachers. This leads him to read the works of Turgenev, Bakunin, and over time he's also being introduced to the ideas of French Enlightenment thinkers. Probably because of these early influences in his life, two things happen. First, he goes through a conscience crisis. He is alienated from earlier religious education, and he feels alienated from what he calls the Eastern world or the Islamic world. And he starts to become more and more interested in the Western, what he calls Western lifestyle. And this is probably why he decides to go to St. Petersburg when he was 18, I suppose. And then when he is 19, he goes to France. And in France, he receives, he takes lessons at Collège de France from Jaime Darmstadt and Ernest Renan, and the ideas of these two thinkers particularly influence him very much as well. Through Renan, especially, he is introduced to the idea of republicanism, though he does not quite talk about it until 1920s. And he is also borrowing from Renan the idea that the most pressing problem of his time in the late 19th century and later in the early 20th century is the predicament of the individual. Renan speaks in the French context and says that our biggest problem is the development of the faculties of the individual. And Ağaoğlu applies this to the Eastern context and says our biggest problem in the Eastern world, in the Islamic world, is the development of the spiritual and intellectual faculties of the individual, and it tries to bring different solutions to them. And in the Ottoman context, when he goes to the Ottoman Empire, he appears as a nationalist. This is partially because in the 1900s, when he was part of the Russian Muslim struggle against the what we can call the autocracy of the Tsarist regime, he is introduced through some Sunni journals, Turkish nationalist ideas. Previously, in 1890s, he calls himself the Persian, but as of 1900s, he becomes a Turkish nationalist. And in 1910s, together with Ziya Gökalp and Yusuf Akçura, he becomes one of the pioneers of Turkish nationalism. And this is how he takes part also in the nationalist Independence War in the early 1920s. He becomes part of the entourage of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, and he appears in the early years of the Republic in the party caucus of the Republican People's Party. He sits at the committees that wrote the first party program of Republican People's Party, and then in 1924 he sits at the committee that drafted the first constitution. And in the 1920s and 30s he appears to be a liberal, and this is where my interest in him grows. I was asking myself, how could an intellectual be a pioneer of nationalism on the one hand, and, as later commentators put it, a liberal individualist on the other hand? How can a person can be a nationalist and liberal individualist at one and the same time? And this is the starting point of the book.
Yeah, and I want to come on to that shortly. But first of all, he came to Istanbul after the Yom Turk Revolution in 1908, and he was coming at the same time as a lot of other prominent Muslims from the Caucasus. Had he been in the Ottoman Empire before? Why did he come to the Ottoman Empire at that time? And what was he doing when he first came?
I think he first came to the Ottoman Empire in 1894, after he finished his studies in Paris. He received a letter that year from Azerbaijan, which was sadly informing him of the death of his parents. And he decided to return to Azerbaijan that year, and he did so via Istanbul. He spent a couple of months between January and May 1894 in Istanbul. He had previously made connections with various Ottoman statesmen and intellectuals, most prominently Ahmet Riza, who was also in Paris in the late 1880s and early 1890s. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but Ahmet Riza was one of the leaders of the Young Turk movement. In fact, he was number one man in at the turn of 1890s, I suppose. In 1890, Ahmet Aoul and Ahmet Riza, they met in Paris and they became good friends. They shared their concerns and ideas about the situation of what, again, they called the Eastern world. And I think one reason that led Aoul to go to Istanbul in 1894 was to increase his contacts with the Young Turks. He already had quite a few acquaintances. Ahmet Riza was not the only person. And he spent, as I said, a couple of months there. And then after the Young Turk Revolution, the reason that he decided to go back to Istanbul is that he had already been in touch with various Young Turks figures. Haniol has already shown this, but he has been exchanging letters with Behattin Şakir and again Ahmet Riza, Dr. Nazım. They were in touch, the leaders of the Russian Muslim Liberation Movement in Baku and the Caucasus, and the Young Turks in the Balkans and Istanbul and different parts of Anatolia. They had already been exchanging letters and exchanging ideas about their causes. They were trying to find commonalities, and if they could act, they were questioning if they could act together. And the reason that he had to leave the Caucasus was that in 1905, after the Russian Revolution, he started a movement called the Defiye Movement, which the defense movement, which aimed at defending Muslim villages against, again, what Aoul took to be Armenian threat. Through Defiye, Aoul wanted to do two things. He was one of the leaders of it. One of them was enlightenment of local Muslims. He started a war against the bigotry and ultra-conservative leanings of the clergy, Muslim clergy in the South Caucasus. On the other hand, he started a war against the Russian government. Defiye was targeting Russian officers. I don't know the exact number, but a number of Russian officers were assassinated by the Defiye movement. And in the second half of 1900s, it was difficult for Aoul to remain in Russia because the Russian police was behind him, Russian authorities were behind him, so he had to escape. So he probably escaped from the Caucasus in late 1908 or early 1909 and came to Istanbul.
Yes, and like you say, through the 1980s, through the 1910s and the 1920s, he espoused quite sort of orthodox Turkish nationalist opinions of the state elites, both before and after the Turkish Republic was founded in 1923. But in the late 1920s, he began to take a more critical stance. What did that mean in practice?
You are right that he was an orthodox nationalist in the 1910s, in the sense that he believed that a Turkish nationality had to be created through turn to the history, culture, historical and cultural products of the Turkish nation. And in the 1920s, during the in the nascent years of the Republic, he continued to embrace these nationalist ideas. The break of Ağolu with the inner circle of the Republican People's Party, but not the Kemalists, came into existence, I think, after 1925. This is when, as you may know, the Islamist Kurdish rebellion took place in the southeast, and this being used as a pretext, and also following the assassination attempt on Mustafa Kemal, the Republican People's Party began to change its position. For Ağolu, if you look at the period between 1923 and 26, and not only for Ağolu, also for, say, British observers, say, such other nationalist writers as Ziya Gökalp, or, say, the Prime Minister of the time, Ali Fethi Okya, the first 3 years of the Republic was a period of liberalism. The leading members of the Republican People's Party would identify themselves as liberals. So would the contemporary press of the time, when the caliphate was abolished or the religious orders were closed. These would appear on the press as the acts of the liberals. And Ağolu was one of the leading intellectuals at the time, one of the doctrinaires who was trying to give a meaning to the change that was going on at the time, to the transfer of power from Istanbul to Ankara and the consolidation of this power at the hands of a relatively smaller group in Ankara. 1926 was the turning point when this liberal discourse began to be dropped. In fact, it was not Ağolu who specifically changed, but it was the direction of the revolution that changed. Ağolu wrote in this year, in 1926, one article called The Direction of the Revolution. And at the same time, he wrote a private report to Mustafa Kemal Pasha, where he was criticizing the actions of the Republican People's Party. The article was very important in that he was saying that the Republican People's Party's revolutionary direction was not carrying the same liberal enthusiasm that it had to carry in the early years of the Republic. And the report was very important in that he was openly criticizing the stagnation of the party, again, the loss of enthusiasm and the corruption of the officials. And he was saying that the acts of the party was severely damaging the prestige of the revolution, and it was losing the charisma, the energy to rally the support of people. So the break happened, Ağolu's alienation happened, when the Republican People's Party turned toward a more authoritarian direction after 1926.
And part of that was his role in the Free Republican Party in 1930, which only lasted for 3 months. But it's a very interesting experiment, really, during that period. Could you just give a few details about what that party involved, how it differed from the Republican People's Party?
Sure. That party was established in August 1930. There are probably three reasons for the establishment of the Free Party. One of them was in 1929, after the Great Depression and after an agrarian crisis, and equally importantly, After the payments of Ottoman debt started, Turkish economy went through a crisis, and the Kemalist leadership wanted to divert attention from debt to political issues. Or instead of Kemalist leadership, maybe I should say the Republican People's Party's leadership. Secondly, figures like Ali Fethi and obviously Ahmet Ağaoğlu were critical of the regime of Hizmet. And third, this is probably a speculation because there is no ample evidence in hand, there was a tension between Mustafa Kemal and Hizmet over who was actually ruling the country. Mustafa Kemal probably wanted to distance Hizmet, which I partly discuss in the book. And for that reason, he asked Ali Fethi to establish a party in the summer of 1913. One thing that we might want to take into account while considering Free Party is that there were indeed two different decision-making mechanisms in the 1920s. One of them was the hardliner Republicans led by Hizmet and Recep, who would later take the surname Peker, Recep Peker, on the one hand. On the other hand, there was the group of Mustafa Kemal and Nuri Jonker, Nuri Bey, and to a much lesser degree, again, Ahmet Ağaoğlu, who were more regularly meeting at Mustafa Kemal's house at Çankaya, the presidential house. Well, we see that in 1930, when the Free Republican People's Party was established, the figures in the entourage of Mustafa Kemal would also go to this party. And in 1930, the relatively more liberal program of Free Party, and it's more, I say more liberal only in economic sense, and also its call for further rights for women and for becoming member of League of Nations, and perhaps most importantly for its opposition to the Republican People's Party, led indeed to a synergy and indeed diverted people's attentions to from economic problems to political issues. And it did inspire hopes for many at the time and was regarded by the leading figures of Republican People's Party as a threat.
And Ağaoğlu in Turkey is today generally seen as a kind of champion of individualism. But you suggest towards the end of the book that it's actually more accurate to view him as a kind of moderate, trying to balance individual and state duties and interests.
I think throughout the book I try to say that Ağaoğlu was an individualist and communitarian at one and the same time, and then I try to explain why. Ağaoğlu was an individualist as far as the state's approach to the individual in political and economic matters were concerned, which means he wanted the basic rights of the individual to be guaranteed by law, and he wanted the individuals to be given a free platform on which to compete economically and freely. This was the economic layer. But on the other hand, there is a moral layer of his liberal thought where he says that the most important moral value of humans is mutual aid. The biggest problem of Eastern societies is egoism. We have egoistic individuals in the East, whereas in the West, you will find altruistic individuals, he argues. And he says that the biggest difference between Eastern and Western nations is that in the East, an individual would easily sacrifice the long-term interests of a society for his or her own short-term interests, whereas in the West, the reverse would be the case. So we understand from the moral layer of his liberal work that he is favoring altruism over egoism, and he is seeing individualism, where his moral thought was concerned, as a synonym of egoism. What Ağaoğlu is doing is that he is envisaging, he has a future projection of Turkish society, which is the aggregate of altruistic individuals, and there is this free liberal state, in his view, which is providing the individuals with a free atmosphere to develop their intellectual, spiritual, or economic faculties. But his liberal account is obviously, as I try to show in the book, suffering from a number of inherent tensions, such as that of between political and economic liberalisms. He doesn't like quite like the Anglo-Saxon version of economic liberalism, and it is not really a big defender of liberal individualism in utilitarian sense. He wants a communitarian nation because he believes that there is no individual happiness beyond the happiness of society, and individual morality is socially constituted. That's why I prefer to call his liberalism a communitarian version of liberalism, but not individualist. He says that the individual's interests or happiness can easily be sacrificed if the interest of the state, or if the maintenance, beka, of the state is under threat. That's why the freedoms that he's endowing to the individuals is mainly serving for the good of collectivity. One good example is his insistence on giving women further political and economic rights. We see that from 1890s onwards through until his death, he's consistently and insistently suggesting endowing women with further rights, because he finds it an ultimate factor for the moral regeneration of society. If there is an imbalance between in the power relations between husband and wife, in that family, Ağaoğlu argues, no children's moral faculties would flourish in a free way. But while he's talking about endowing women with rights, he's wanting to give women further political and economic rights, not for their own happiness per se, but for them to become more conscious mothers and wives for their social role. He wants to give individuals political and economic rights, but for their social function, for them to improve society, develop society, but not for their happiness per se. And by this happiness per se, I'm referring to the fact that he is not giving the individual autonomy in moral sense.
And just as a final thing, today, after 13 years of AKP rule, it's clear that this kind of habit of illiberal state social engineering still remains a goal of most politicians in Turkey. Do you see any prospect that this can change or will change?
Well, I think this is a question that is beyond the scope of my book, because it does not quite address the contemporary issues and problems. I'm hoping so. To be perfectly honest, one way of linking the liberalisms of 1920s and 30s to contemporary issues is that Ağaoğlu's liberalism and the Kemalist project, if we can call it retrospectively so, they were indeed design theories of some kind, giving too much stress on individual human reason, drawing from a conclusion, as Hayek argues in 1940s, social processes can be made to serve human ends only if they are subject to the control of individual human reason. So there is this belief that individual human reason will allow restructuring society in one way or another. In the 1920s and 30s, the human reason, the bigger human reason of the communists, were suggesting the re-engineering of society toward a more nationalist and positivist sense, which they associated, and Westernist sense, which they associated with modernization. And in the 2000s, especially after 2011, we find, which is popularly called today, an Islamic Kemalism, again, an engineering toward a more conservative direction. And again, we find that power is concentrated at the hands of one party or an individual, even worse. And the lifestyle of the group who is holding power is being exerted upon the broader society through different channels. I think the problem of 1920s and 30s and 2000s, in fact, the problem of Republican Turkey throughout was the absence of a liberal democratic culture which is giving importance to individual autonomy. By that, I'm referring to the idea that there was a liberal movement in Turkey in the 1920s and 30s. I don't think Kemalists were false in identifying themselves as liberals, because they were carrying the characteristics of many political liberals of 19th century Europe, who were embracing the discourse of capacity, who were not quite sure about democracy. In fact, some of them were anti-democrat, and they were fearing the rule of mob. But they never managed to marry this liberalism with a democratic mentality. They were talking of political rights, though they were curbing them enormously, but they never talked of marrying the basic liberal rights with broader democratic expectations. In 2010s, there is this discourse of democracy, the majority, the rule of majority, as the ruling Justice and Development Party understands. But this understanding of democracy today has not been married with basic liberal rights. Today, journalists are still being jailed. In fact, Turkey is probably still the number one country in the world at the moment who puts journalists in prison. Rights are still being curbed today. There is this enormous pressure on media, on other political parties. I think once the idea of democracy is married with liberal rights, we can talk of a more bright future for Turkey. But at the moment, I'm not very positive about it, because the liberal democratic culture, the marriage, is hardly being embraced by large groups of people, given the still extremely strong ultra-nationalism and conservatism in Turkey, which are very distant to basic liberal expectations, economic, political, and moral. I am not very positive at this stage, but I am hoping to be optimistic sometime soon.
That was Ozan Özavcı. On my blog, you can find a link to my review of his book called Ahmet Ağoğlu and the Genealogy of Liberalism in Turkey. There's also a link to an edited text of this interview and others at the Hürriyet Daily News. You can also subscribe to this podcast via iTunes, Podbean and SoundCloud. And if you liked it, please take the time to rate it on iTunes, which helps spread the word and helps make it easier for people to find the podcast. Meanwhile, thank you very much for listening. Tellidir, tellim anam, tellidir, tellidir amma.